Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 1195.jb0607, certificate number 53117. Spam!
You're a foodie.
I like food quite a bit.
Of the two of us, who is the foodiest?
You have more food in your beard right now than I do.
Yes, I have more beard than you do.
But you have more beard in your food.
I do.
That's how you get food in your beard.
But you and Mindy do try to eat at the new restaurants. You're always trying to get a seat or a table at a place that's hard to get a table.
Yeah, but not for that reason.
Oh.
I have a friend who's kind of obsessed with that. Like, okay, I'm going to be in such and such a city. What are the hardest tables to get?
Right.
And how do I figure this out?
It's just gamifying eating.
Basically, like if I have an American Express Black card, can I get a table at Noma?
Right.
And
can you?
Apparently for this guy, yeah, they have some concierge service that can help you with very tables.
Oh, of course they do.
Tables.
The concierges that I never remember exist.
See, this is a good story because it makes me look like a man of the people because I'm like, would you believe this bozo?
Would you believe this rich friend of mine that gets into the crazy restaurants? But you like to do it around here when somebody's like, we're opening a new fusion Thai Mexican restaurant in a garage.
You're joking, but we're actually going to this Turkish-owned Texas barbecue place tonight.
Yeah.
Because it's super good and it's brand new.
Yeah. And was it hard to get in?
No. We're man of the people.
Yeah, sure. But you know somebody that knows somebody?
No, it's just it's a less formal place to eat. But there are lots of places where there's this one restaurant we like in London. And when we go there, I always forget to look. And it's the kind of place that does still book up.
Yeah.
2.5 months in advance. And so I'm always like, Mindy, I forgot to get a good time at. So.
My friend Jonah, who now owns Linda's Tavern. He bought Linda's from Linda, the eponymous Linda.
The titular Linda.
But Jonah was in a punk band called Schoolyard Heroes, and now he's an impresario of bars. But he likes to eat food, weirdly. But he's one of the guys that calls me up and is like, hey, there's a new halal Chinese food restaurant in a mall in Kent. And so we have to go. And so he and I will drive down there with his wife. And we go into these like crazy malls.
I love when it's a strip mall.
It's just like some mall that where you're walking around, you're like, what are even all these places? Like, can this possibly be a store? And then we walk in and it's like, it's lit up like a police station. And somebody comes over and they're like, well, listen, all this food is served inside of phyllo dough, but basically it's all lamb, but it's Chinese food, but it's not. And we're like, bring it, whatever, you know, like don't even let us look at the menu. But generally I do not eat in restaurants where you have to prepare in advance because most of the restaurants I go to serve pancakes.
probably the other way around. You go to the pancake restaurants because you don't plan things
right
in months in advance, let alone dinner out.
Even hours in advance. So usually it's 6 o'clock and I'm like, food.
Right.
And I go, what's open? Well, pancake restaurants, basically, or places that are serving like Afghani Thai food, and I don't even know about them.
Well, the good thing is pancakes are the best food.
They are.
And ethnic food from trucks is the best food.
Also good.
So you're not really missing out. You're probably missing out on a lot of fussy food that would annoy you anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Although every once in a while I do go to one of these places that's like, oh no, it's Turkish pancakes in a garage. And I'm like, this is actually pretty good. It's interesting that it has snakes in it, but you know, I didn't realize how much I like snake.
I would say a lot of the high-end places are like legitimately objectively good, but yeah, they're also not 18 times as good as the food that they are 18 times more expensive than. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to be like, yeah, that was fine, but I'm just going to go to my pancake place next time.
But what's your exposure to / interest in peasant food? When you're overseas, when you're bopping around, like how much of that is sometimes a conceit? Like this is a $64 plate of what would be Kazaki like garbage plate, but because you can't get it here, now it's like a gourmet.
I thought you were asking about actual like.
Well, and I am asking that too.
Like, because you know, if you're in Asia, you eat plenty of food truck food and night market food and, you know, if you're in Japan, convenience store food, there's good food that's for everyone.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. More so in other cultures than in ours, I feel like.
Yeah.
But
people would say we have really good food for everybody. It's just, we think of it as garbage. But in fact, everybody else in the world is lining up at McDonald's.
It's true.
All over the world, just like, give me that McDonald's.
But I feel like we somehow fooled them, or like it was just a marketing trick we did.
I don't know. Like, when was the last time you had a McDonald's?
McDonald's is actually better now.
Yeah, but when was the last time you had one?
Okay, it's been years.
I haven't had it in a long time either, but I do go to Wendy's.
The last time I went to McDonald's, the quarter pounder was now never frozen, fresh ground beef.
Whoa, how do they do that?
It's like a new thing they do.
When was the last time you went to a Wendy's?
Probably longer, but I did used to prefer Wendy's.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Like if Mindy and I were going to go get a fast food burger, we would use. The thing is now all those places have been replaced by the places that cost twice as much, but are like 20% better. So you can go to Five Guys or Shake Shack or.
Sure.
You know, those guys are everywhere now.
Yeah, that's
and it's
true.
It's really cut down on my Burger King going. Don't tell the king.
Well, McDonald's and Burger King are going to figure into our episode later. How familiar, now that you're like a part-time resident of the United Kingdom.
I'm really not, but okay.
How familiar are you with the different ways that butchers in France, England, Germany, and the United States approach cutting up a carcass of beef or of pork?
Ooh, the dotted lines are in different places?
They're in different places.
Yeah, one thing I have noticed is like, as food culture has changed, like they've invented new cuts of steak.
Yes, they
and
have.
As far as I know, the cow has not grown any new parts.
Doesn't appear to.
Which means they're giving you a kind of meat that they could always have given you, either just cut differently, butchered differently, or with a different name.
Yes.
And I've come to learn what some of those are and which ones I like, but it's very confusing because you're like, no. I know the six steaks.
Yes. Both things are true.
There's chuck, flank, sirloin, T-bone, filet. Like I know the steaks. And now there's new magic steaks.
Well, and what's even crazier is that what they call a sirloin in the UK is a completely different part of the cow from what we call a sirloin. And their sirloin is what we would call a porterhouse.
Mm.
And what we call a sirloin, they call a rump steak. It's very, it's like cuts are moving all around the cow.
The cow must hate that.
I mean,
whoa,
who knows what a cow thinks?
What's going on in there?
I mean, some of the cows probably do have new parts.
My parts are moving. Where's your bell? I have a bell.
Boo. Yeah, I should hit here. I'm going to get.
Oh, we both have a bell.
Two bells.
Beautiful.
I got a two bell.
Ding dong.
But I experienced this kind of my first awareness came. I don't know if I've ever told you, but one time, a long time ago now, I walked across Europe. Oh, I get a bell for
that
too.
That's what my bell is for.
And
it's going to wear out.
I was routinely in Central Europe and beyond. Central Europe and beyond. People would offer me bacon that when it arrived was, to my eye, to my American eye, was just fat. It was just a slab of fat. Mm-hmm. No, what I would describe as meat was on it at all.
We are the culture that does bacon right.
Yeah.
Every other
Canadians
culture has something.
Might yell at us about that.
Yeah, they have something else they call bacon, which is slightly inferior.
Yeah, that's right.
To it's our streaky bacon. Streaky bacon.
And our bacon. I had this conversation with a guy in Romania where I said, finally, after weeks and weeks and weeks of being served fat back, I said, because he was like, oh, our bacon is this, that, and the other.
Fat
and
back.
I said,
like you're building the railroad.
I said, you know, in the United States, what we call bacon is, you know, it's something else. It does have some fat, but it also has meat in it. And he said, well, American pigs are better than Romanian pigs.
What?
And they have meat in their bacon where ours do not.
Our pigs have been working out.
Well, it just is it's an example of conversations that you sometimes have in other countries where people ascribe to the United States like very unlikely superpowers.
A mythical quality.
It's like, I think our pigs and your pigs are very similar to one another.
He's like, no. I watch MTV Music Award every year.
And fatback is a thing that is on all pigs. It's their back, which is fat. And
it's on me too.
In our case, in American butchering, we cut that off and we huck it over here in the pile of things that we're going to use for something else.
Not in nose to tail butchery. You don't. You figure out some way to trick yuppies into eating it.
Well, but yeah, I suppose that's true. You just call it British fatback or something. I think what happens is it gets cut up and put into other schmutz. But fatback is its own cut of meat in Europe that is often, in Romania, served as bacon.
And they just like to have a slice of fat with their...
Yeah.
With their what?
Yeah.
With breakfast?
Yeah.
They, eggs and a slice of fat?
They fry it up and eat it like it is not just the fat.
Do they eat it like it's going out of style?
I kind of do. I think I was served it in many instances where it was the meat. There was not another meat component because I think it's, you know, it's probably not as expensive as what we would call bacon.
Right. I assume they can do something better with the, I mean, not better, but they have other uses for the thing we would call bacon.
They must. Not being a butcher, and you also not being a butcher, we're sort of just talking. It's just sort of like when we were talking about leather, I was explaining all the different grades of leather. And then I got a DM from a guy who was like, my family's in the leather business and has been for a long time. And
what are you talking about?
Let me just break it down for you. And he was complimentary about the show. He was like, yes, exactly. Except let me just add a little flavor.
He did a little sandwich compliment for you.
He did. He did.
Or compliment sandwich.
And it was, I learned a lot that I probably should have, he should have sent that to the addenda show, or I should have forwarded it to you. Because I'm just now realizing me learning more about it doesn't help the omnibus.
It helps you personally.
Be more right. I feel better.
You're enriched. It. You would order something less gross the next time you were eating in a Romanian bistro.
Correct. Correct.
That's important.
And sort of like the genuine leather situation, in this situation, in terms of
the GLS, that's my favorite Guns N' Roses record. The genuine leather situation,
the GLS of this show is going to be, well, it's not a major component of the show, but there's a very big difference between what butchers call primal cuts and what we in the United States think of as a prime cut.
What's the primal cut? Wow.
Yeah,
like cavemen used to eat it.
Yeah. A prime is a way that the U.S. grades the quality of meat. And there's, what are the different?
Oh, like choice and select and whatever?
Right.
So it's a USDA quality thing?
Yeah, they're different grades. I think when the inspector goes in and looks at the beef hanging on a hook.
Back when the Department of Agriculture had employees.
Back when it still existed.
We need to explain this to our listeners.
They would walk through and they'd look at a beef and they'd say, that one looks good, and that's prime, and this one looks pretty good, and that's choice, and this one looks like that cow was limping before it went into the chute.
And prime is the best one, right?
I think so, yeah. And it's more expensive and it's harder to get. A lot fewer cows are rated prime. And if you go to really nice restaurants, they'll try and tell you that all their steaks are prime. And when you go to Costco, they actually have prime beef there. It's quite a bit more expensive. But primal cuts are how they describe the first whack at the cow when they're like, we're going to cut this into just a few parts. The front part, the back part, the middle part. You know, it's like, whoosh,
is this whoosh, something that still whoosh. Happens in butchery, but it'll be like the first stage?
It's the first stage, okay. Right. When you think of like
a side of beef first gets cut into.
Well, it's a side first.
Well, first, yeah, right. I guess that's it. What is that, a half?
Yeah.
I assume.
Just the one half.
I mean, all right I know is what I see in the Rocky movies.
Exactly.
But it looks like half a cow.
Yeah, if you're going to cut a...
Apologies to our vegetarian listeners.
Yeah, this is going to be a rough one for you if you're vegetarian, but you should have known that from looking at the title.
But also, we're helping because we're going to make meat sound gross, which you probably agree it is.
We're going to go down that road for a while, yeah.
But you're going to swing around and say meat is not gross.
No, there's never going to be there's no turns out at the end of this where it's like, but actually, meat is amazing. If you don't already think that it's amazing, like, I'm not going to win you over with this story.
Yeah, I think we're not convincing anyone either way.
But if you take a pig, let's say you kill a pig. Let's say it's a nice pig. It's a pig that you named and you raised from small because you were in the 4-H club.
Because you're Nicolas Cage.
And then you kill it.
Oh.
In preparation for eating it, you whack it up at first into a few parts, and they are like hams and loins, pork hams. There's a cut of pig called the picnic.
Really?
Yep, which is part of the shoulder of the pig.
I'm hungry for picnic.
There's a belly, the belly of the pig.
Pork belly.
And something called the Boston butt.
None of the others, by the way, have a city.
Nope.
But suddenly there's one colorful part of the pig called the Boston butt.
And the Boston butt is kind of next to picnic or, you know, when in the first whack, maybe the Boston butt and the picnic are together. But it's called the Boston butt because it's a cut of pig that doesn't exist. It's not how they whack up pigs in the UK or in Germany. I think in Germany, almost all of the pig goes into sausage, with the exception of some like schnitzels. I think they cut schnitzels out of it.
The first thing they do with the pig is make it into sausage.
They put the whole thing through a sausage maker. And in the UK, you know, they eat a lot of ham, right? The people eat ham all over the world, except our aforementioned Muslim Chinese people. And actually, a lot of the world doesn't eat ham, right. But
anybody who's halal or kosher really doesn't eat ham.
Doesn't eat it at all, doesn't want it around. But then there are other countries where it's really the number one food, ham.
Like in my house.
In your house.
A ham-centric world.
You live in a ham-centric world?
I do love pork.
I mean, in China, don't they eat a lot more ham than...
Yeah, that Chinese pork, kind of red pork.
Yeah, they're not going to, but they're not good. They don't eat as many beefs as we do. That's part of the reason that the beefs are such a problem.
You really have to be a place with space.
Yeah.
If you're from Argentina or the US, there's a reason to eat a ton of beef. Everywhere else. Beef. And in fact, ecologically, we probably shouldn't be eating that much even here.
No, you can put 50 pigs in the space that one cow needs. And I've done it. Quote me on that.
No, I've done it. The cow gets very angry, but it's very illustrative.
Because they're down there biting on his ankles.
Why are there 50 pigs here? Not again.
50 pigs.
50. What was the Twitter thing?
Oh, yeah. 50
angry, wild hogs.
Angry hogs.
I don't remember what the number was.
Yeah, probably 69.
30 to 50 feral hogs.
That's what it was.
Can take up the space of one feral cow.
Before I got kicked off of Twitter, I made a lot of 30 to 50 feral hogs jokes. And then when I did get kicked off of Twitter, I had to think back over the course of my life and go, you know what? You joined in on the 30 to 50 feral hogs joke.
Now people are joining in on you.
Yeah. So why are you so mad? You
pig karma.
Exactly. I had to get a lot of empathy for people that were making me the butt of the joke. Speaking of butts.
The Boston butt of the joke.
The Boston butt of the joke. The reason it's called Boston Butt is that in colonial America, this particular cut of pork, it's not the most popular cut. It's the kind of shoulder. It's not. That's the thing. Boston butt is not the butt of the pig. It's. I'm sorry. It's not. It has nothing to do with the butt of the pig.
Why? What is it the butt of?
Well,
it, besides this joke,
the thing is that a butt is in the United Kingdom a measurement of liquid volume.
Right. Because they say arse.
An arse.
So they have the word butt free to be something else.
Yeah.
Got it.
They would say the arse of a pig. Is very Boston different from a arse. Butt. If you think about a barrel of beer, a butt is sort of, I mean, it's more than a barrel. A butt is 108 imperial gallons of liquid, which is 130 U.S. gallons. In the United Kingdom, there are different, a butt of beer and a butt of ale are different amounts.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So
even, I mean, I think I, until now, might have thought that beer and ale were like maybe the same thing.
They're different.
Apparently, and measured differently.
A barrel of beer is 36 gallons. A barrel of ale is 32 gallons.
So you, what you want is a barrel of beer because you'll get more.
You're going to get more. But is ale better than beer? This is a question for our brewery friends. I don't know if this is still true.
Do you think anybody who listens to this is interested in homebrewing beer?
140,000%. Because whenever I do an alcohol show, I also get a lot of DMs from people that are like, I'm not going to say you were wrong about everything, but you were wrong about literally everything.
You were not paying enough attention to alcohol during the time of your life when you were paying so much attention to alcohol.
Well, because when I was paying attention to alcohol, it was in a time back when the only vodka was Smirnoff, the only whiskey was Jack Daniels, the only bourbon was, I don't know, Jim Beam.
They just had one brand.
Those bourbons. I don't even know the difference.
Which is still the same for me because it's all Kirkland brand.
Yeah, that's right.
That's my one brand.
There wasn't even lemon-flavored vodka. Stolichnaya still felt like a thing you had to get in Poland.
Wow.
So anyway, I missed out on all the stuff. We had Red Hook and Hefeweizen, but that was pretty much it.
If they'd invented lemon-flavored vodka, maybe you would still drink. Maybe that would have been the thing.
See, they should have gotten it in under the wire and I'd be drinking it still.
You got out at the right time.
Peach schnapps. I drank peach schnapps. I drank 10 High Whiskey, which came in a gallon plastic bottle.
The rest of the show should just be you listing things you drank once.
Southern Comfort.
Because I could do it too.
Awful.
I drank that V8 that has fruit in it. Do they still make that?
Anyway, half of a barrel is a kilderkin. Half of a kilderkin is a firkin.
This is like Rip Van Winkle.
I know.
A kilderkin.
Kilderkin of ale. But a kilderkin of ale is only 16 gallons, where a kilderkin of beer is 18 gallons. I'm basing this on a piece of parchment I found in the bottom of a hogshead. A hogshead is one half of a butt.
What's bigger, a hogshead or a demijohn?
Oh, a hogshead's bigger than a demijohn.
I bet a demijohn is smaller than a john, though.
And all of these, I think a butt is actually one half of a ton.
A demijohn is also known as a carboy, which is my new favorite thing.
A carboy.
How much beer do you want? Oh, just give me a carboy.
A carboy.
I don't know if you've noticed, John, but fall is upon us.
I have noticed.
I got back into town after being gone for a month and the weather was different. All the trees were beautiful colors.
Yeah, it rained last night, which is such a relief.
But fall gets busy, right? Kids are back in school. Yep. The days are getting shorter.
My kid just texted me. She's out of school at the moment. She just texted me, "I'm in so much trouble, dude." And I wrote back.
That's what you want to hear.
I wrote back, "What happened?" And she wrote, "I'll tell you later, but it has something to do with Catholicism." And I'm like, oh my God. She's in high school now.
I mean, that could be a worst case scenario. That's not what you want to hear from your teenager.
Yeah, beats me up.
I don't want to tell you what traumatic thing happened to me, but hint, Catholicism.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Well, when things are getting so busy and hectic in the fall, it's harder and harder if you're trying to get dinner on the table, to get the family together for dinner. it's not easy.
It's really hard for me lately because I'm taking a GLP-1 and a lot of food doesn't sound appetizing. A lot of the garbage food that I used to eat no longer is appealing. I want like fresh, delicious, sort of home-cooked meals. I'm tired of eating trash.
Let me recommend, as we have in the past, Factor.
Yeah, they're the best.
As we've mentioned before, these are chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals. So something comforting and delicious no matter what time of year. And check this out. Like, I think they now know, with a lot of people on these GLP-1s, a lot of their meals are designed to be GLP-1 friendly.
Isn't that great?
Mediterranean diet options, because it's hard to get enough protein when you're on one of these. That's the main thing.
You don't want all the fat and salt that used to sound so delicious.
And yet, like, carbs sound really good, but Factor's got your back here. They got a wider selection than ever of weekly meal options. You get like premium seafood stuff like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost.
Totally great.
There's these Asian-inspired meals if you feel like Thai or Chinese tonight.
I had a scallop risotto just the other day.
Well, it's not Thai or Chinese, but thank you for
But it's part of the seafood.
There you go.
Seafood family.
There you go. 97, I didn't know this. This is new stuff. 97% of customers say that Factor helped them live a healthier life.
97%.
And that's not what you'd expect for like prepared meals, you know?
No, that's right. And that's the thing.
But it works.
They're not processed meals that you get like a freezer meal or something like that. It's like, just the ingredients.
Yes. If you're expecting a TV dinner, like this is such good stuff. John and I are both fans. Shall we offer our listeners a special secret access to a special secret offer?
Nothing would make me happier.
Really? Because I'm a little mad that they get this cool offer. I think maybe you and I should just keep this for ourselves.
No, I want to share it because you know how much I love the Omnibus listeners, unlike you.
John loves the fans, I guess.
Yeah, futurelings, this is for you.
Eat smart at factormeals.com/, here's the code, Omnibus50Off. Omnibus50Off. And then use code OMNIBUS50OFF. As implied, you will get 50% off your first box. Can you believe that?
Dag.
Plus, this is just some random thing we're going to throw in. Free breakfast for 1 year. Free breakfast for 1 year.
Free breakfast?
I feel like that's, I mean, I would buy anything if it came with free breakfast for a year.
I didn't used to eat breakfast because it wasn't appealing. And also I ate 10,000 calories of pasta every night.
But are you super hungry waking up after your GLP-1?
I am, and I want some protein in the morning.
So the code, again, OMNIBUS50OFF at factormeals.com. You will get 50% off your first box. And what is it, John?
Free breakfast for a year.
For a year. Delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase.
A ton is actually a liquid measure in this story because it's spelled T-U-N.
Right.
It's related, of course, to a ton, a T-O-N.
You are Grandpa Simpson at this point. But we had a ton, but a liquid measure with a U.
Was the other kind. I used to carry a ton on my belt. So a Boston butt is actually a reference to a barrel full of pork shoulders because it wasn't the preferred part of the pig. And so they would prepare it, you know, they'd salt it and they'd throw a bunch of them in a barrel.
Oh, so just like salt pork?
For
winter?
We're going to put all these, and then, you know, they'd bring it out, they'd use it as a roast. But the butt was actually a reference to the way that they stored these porks.
In Boston.
In colonial New England. That's right.
Okay.
So now our story is going to fast forward to the Gilded Age.
Oh.
Because when does an omnibus not have a Gilded Age component?
And because you've been binging the Gilded Age, I think.
I've been watching the Gilded Age because it has Meryl Streep's youngest daughter.
What's her name? Gumbo?
Gumbo, yeah.
Her daughter Gumbo.
Her daughter Gumbo. Janice's son on The Sopranos? Her son Gumbo that she never talked to? I don't remember. All the shows that I've binged before.
Richie Abreu?
Which is 5 shows that I've ever seen. No, we're going to go now to the hog raisin capital of the United States, which is the Minnesota-Iowa border region.
That's hog country?
Hog country USA. Now, every part of the world, all of our listeners in the various parts of the world that are not America, North America, America, USA America. I'm sorry, because there are a lot of Canadians who also eat all the pigs. But in the U.S., the number one pork-producing state is?
Texas.
No, not by a long shot. It's Iowa, the great state of Iowa.
I mean, you just said Iowa, so I assumed it wasn't going to be Iowa. Okay, well, it's Iowa.
Faked you out.
I'm with you now.
The thing is that Minnesota also makes a lot of pigs, and Minnesota is very pig-oriented.
But see, I didn't know.
They've got all that north part of Minnesota where they're doing other things. I don't know, water skiing and stuff on all the lakes.
Iowa is more concentrated pig.
Just pig after pig after pig.
You have to just walking in from the airport, you're like kind of stepping through waist-high pigs.
Iowa produces 33 million hogs a year, which is a lot of hogs. And if you've ever been around that part of Iowa, the hogs are as thick as bugs on a bumper. They have...
Dan Rather.
They have miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of pigs. You can imagine how irritated the cows are in Iowa because they've got 50 feral hogs, 50 tamed hogs for every cow. Maybe more.
Probably fewer feral ones.
Yeah, no, they're all pretty domesticated pigs.
Feral ones are all down in Arkansas or whatever.
One of the things about pigs is that if you had a bunch of them and you were like, hey, pigs... Here's 100 acres. You can just roam around. The pigs would find the soggiest, muddiest hole, and then they would all go there.
They'd all just pack in.
And pack in and lay on top of
each other.
Well,
that explains how you can get so many hogs into Iowa.
Yeah.
It's like Tetris.
They're not. I mean, the whole thing about free-range chickens, they really realize is if you let chickens just go free-range, they will 100% all get eaten by foxes within the hour. So when they talk about free-range chickens, what they really are is chickens that are eating
a bigger coop.
Yeah, they're eating grass, but they've got a roof over their heads that kind of moves around as the chickens move around. They're not. You don't just let chickens go. Chickens are going to go under a bush, and then a fox is going to eat them.
Well, it's going to be hard to catch them later.
Yeah,
you're going to have a comic scene where you're running across a barnyard,
exactly.
Maybe with an axe.
Chickens don't come when you call, or at least I mean I'm sure there are some chicken lovers out there that are like my chickens do. But, you know, a bunch of chickens, if you have 1,000 chickens. Hogs, I think, maybe will come. But anyway, that's all beside the point.
Not to me. I'm hanging on every word.
Yeah, thank you. If you're going to try and raise goats, it's nice to have...
It's for a big them, if, but okay.
It's nice for them to have at least something that's higher than the other goats that they can fight over to get up on top
of.
Oh,
they love to get on top of things.
Yeah. Pigs like to get down in the muck. They seem happy.
Would you say temperamentally you're a goat or a pig? You down in the mire with the other pigs, or are you like, I actually know the answer here.
Yeah.
I'm climbing up on this roof.
I'm kind of shaped like a pig, but I act like a goat.
You are a goat, yes.
Yeah. So in this region, and that, you know, I like to give a shout out to Iowa because Iowa gets the short shrift, I think, when people talk about the United States. But Iowa really is a great state, the great state of Iowa.
Why are you kissing up to the Hawkeyes?
I really like Iowa, but we're going to be talking about Minnesota, also a great state.
So why were we talking about Iowa then?
Because we're talking about pigs.
I told you that story so I can tell you this story.
In 1891, George Hormel... founded the Hormel Foods Company.
Who else could have done it?
That's right. In Austin, Minnesota.
Austin, Minnesota.
Austin, Minnesota. This will be confusing at the very end of the story because Austin, Texas does get involved. But in Austin, Minnesota, George Hormel founded Hormel Foods, and they were making food out of pigs and other things, pigs and chickens.
I'm trying to think what I used to buy that was Hormel. I assume now they're part of some big conglomerate, but...
Hormel made it all.
Like lunch meat? Is that what Hormel made?
Hormel makes all the lunch meats. Hormel makes Hormel chili.
Hormel, oh, yeah, chili. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Yes, there was canned Hormel food.
But if you go to the grocery store and you look in the processed meat aisle, you're going to find Hormel is behind a lot of different sort of processed foods. They're probably not the company that does the worst job of processing foods. You know, one of the things...
what an endorsement.
One of the things that I find now when I go to the doctor and I'm like, doctor, what's wrong with me? And the doctor says, everything, literally everything.
Then you need a list.
One of the things that the doctors say and all of the woo magazines and even probably Secretary of the, whatever they're calling it now.
Health and Human Services.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy. They're all going to agree on the same thing, which is the way that Americans process foods is over-processing. And in Germany, the tomatoes taste like tomatoes and the snozzberries taste like snozzberries. And here in America, everything just tastes like rubber underwear.
There is some truth to this.
Yes.
Right?
Well, as somebody that eats at Noma, why don't you tell us?
I don't eat at Noma. I make fun of my friends who do. But yeah, produce-wise, I think everybody's gone to, if you've traveled to other countries, you're like, oh, wow, these carrots and tomatoes have not just been bred to fit the most of them in a truck or ripen the most slowly.
Right.
Some of these taste good.
And the thing about food is, yes, it's not just the preservatives that we put in food to make it last a long time, but also, as we've talked about on pretty recent Omnibus, the food coloring, the other, some of the food coloring that's literally paint. But also anytime you take food, even the good stuff, even that's like, oh, this is vegetarian and it's super delicious smoothie. It's like once it's been through four or five different processes of being chopped and reinforced and promulgated and distended and discombobulated.
Yeah, you got to distend your food.
Yeah.
Put it through the distender.
It's something is lost, and whatever is gained is diabetes.
Well, there is some evidence for this, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot.
Like, this is not just woo health food stuff.
No, it's true. And I think
one thing I read said it's hard to measure because the processed food nomenclature means basically. I don't know what the ultimate example of this is, but like a box of raisins is processed food.
Yes.
But so is a box of Mike and Ike's, you know, and it's
right.
And clearly one of those is like a better snack than the other one, but just calling it processed food doesn't really tease out which processes are bad for you and which are not.
Yeah. Some have yellow dye number four and some don't. It's surprising how many do that you would think don't.
I mean, I just want as much yellow dye five as I can.
But the number of foods in America that are just like, why is there this much fat and salt and sugar in a thing that feels like it doesn't need any of those three? It's pretty astonishing. And it's why
we have the palates of like 4-year-olds. That's why.
That's right. And it's why I have the health of a 94-year-old.
You got pre-diabetes.
Yeah. I basically have the heart of someone who was in Vietnam and was literally the Agent Orange sprayer. Not to say that that Hormel Foods had anything to do with this, but they were the company that developed the first canned ham in the United States. Now, people have been canning ham for as long as there's been ham and canning. We've talked about canning on the Omnibus before.
What was Hormel's innovation?
Just like a tin of ham that they were selling that wasn't just like a... Because have you ever had ham that's been canned like by a grandma in a jar?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Does it have that jelly-like goo the way a canned ham does?
You put ham in a jar and you heat it up. And if you're jarring ham, you know, you actually pour fat on it. But then as part of the cooking of the ham, it will release that gelatin, and that actually forms a kind of cap on the ham that keeps the bacteria out.
Does it become the shape of the jar? Because canned ham is always the shape of the can.
Yeah, canned ham that goes in a jar is not, like, mostly canned ham is ham that has been super masticated, right? Like, super ground up and smooshed in. Whereas in my experience, when a grandma cans a ham...
But enough about your personal life.
Well, a grandma cans of ham, it's really just like a chunk of pork that goes in the jar. She's not generally sitting there and also chopping it into a million bits, because when she pulls that out, it's going to be dinner.
It's a contiguous piece of a pig.
Yeah.
And that's not true of canned ham.
No, canned tinned ham.
Tinned ham has been pressed from 20 different pigs?
Well, or yeah, right. It's, I mean, it's, it, it originally it was ham in a can. As we'll see, that kind of changes over time, but that was in 1926, as late as 1926, Hormel was, innovating with flavor sealed ham, our first true like canned ham product. They followed that with canned chicken.
The can is, it'd be funny if the can was the shape of a chicken.
That would be funny. Kind of like good? A kind of like an Easter egg chocolate bunny, except
yeah, but it looks like a, it looks like a rubber chicken, but it's made of metal.
Oh, right. It would be a chicken made of chicken, not a chicken made of ham.
Right. That, otherwise, it'd be confusing.
There are a lot of like sound bites that you could take out of this show and put to a rap beat. And
which one would that be?
I don't know. It would be, you and I have both
chicken
said
chicken filled with chicken.
It's a chicken made of chicken, not a chicken made of ham. Chicken made of chicken.
I don't know if that's so good for that. It would just be a weird voice in an Avalanche's song.
If you have listened to a lot of the early radio shows featuring George Burns and Gracie Allen, which I know you have.
Oh, boy.
Those shows
were as soon as we get done here today.
Sponsored by Hormel Flavor Sealed Ham. Huh. The Burns and Allen shows were all ham and canned ham and canned chicken funded.
Were they ham themed? Was Hormel like, was Big Ham like, hey, could you guys talk more, do more comedy about how if you don't eat ham, your marriage will suffer?
Yeah. What? How could we integrate ham, but specifically canned ham into this?
Canned ham is a funny meat.
This theme. Yeah, it is.
Canned it's ham, one of the funnier meats.
I think it because it rhymes. Canned beef doesn't sound.
Canned ham.
Canned chicken sounds funny because you're picturing putting a chicken in a can. Because ham is not pig. It's not canned pig. It's canned ham.
What's the least funny meat?
Ooh.
Pot roast is funny.
Long pig.
No.
I mean, it's pretty funny, but it's not. You wouldn't want it in a can.
That's pretty dark.
Yeah. In 36, Hormel, because here's what Hormel is doing. They're killing a lot of pigs. And they're using every part of the pig because that's, you know, they're part of our American heritage. But there are some parts of the pig that are easier to part with than others. Lots of people want good parts of the pig. Not that many people want the bad parts of the pig.
Fair enough.
Like, have you ever had trotters?
Trotters are just the hooves, aren't they?
Just the hooves.
Pig feet? I have. No, wait. Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Not my favorite.
Well, you lived in Spain, and they eat them there.
See.
If you look at the way a European person chops up a pig and the way an American person chops up a pig, in Europe, they have trotters as a separate element of the primal cut.
They just go to the trotters first. They're like, oh, boy.
Oh, the trotters.
I'm just going to eat these now.
In America, we lop the trotters in with the rest of the pig foot that nobody wants.
The garbage meat?
Well, and I'm sure it goes into hot dogs, as everything does.
Yep.
But canned ham is using ham, which is not a universal catch-all term for everything that comes from a pig. It's the ham is one of the primal cuts. It's part of the pig. It's what we would call the rump or the butt. But it's not the butt.
Once again, a funny meat.
It's pretty funny. And it's weird that hog's heads would be a sub, like a subunit of a butt. A butt is two hog's heads. We're putting ham butts, or we're putting pig butts in a butt.
Is the origin of hog's head that it's like, it was roughly the size of the head of a pig, a thing that everybody could picture?
That's a really good idea. Could you put two heads of a hog in a hog's head?
I assume so.
I mean, a hog's head is 54 gallons. That's more than one head of a hog.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like, hey, put it in the one that's the size of a hog's head.
No.
It's too big.
Well, yeah, and right, you're not going to...
You think it's a shape thing?
You're not going to transport... No, it's shaped like a barrel. You're not going to transport hog's heads one at a time. You're presumably going to put as many of them in space as you can fit.
It may be a coincidence.
Can you imagine...
It might just be an English corruption of a different word.
If your job was, hey, kid, get as many pig heads into that barrel as you can, that would suck. Thinking about that would suck.
I'd be like, oh, boy. Can I have a nickel?
Oh, boy, mister. In 36, Hormel, trying to figure out a way to use every part of everything, came out with Hormel canned chili, mm-hmm. which I've had plenty of.
Does that mean they're also a beef company? Because most, if Chile has meat in it, it's usually beef.
They are, by this point in time, Hormel's a major company. They're processing all kinds of bits and bobs.
They've got the meats.
They've got the meats. That's right. That's right. They do have the meats.
Before Arby's had the meats, Hormel had them. At what point do you think Arby's seized all the meats from Hormel?
Arby's does not have all the meats.
They say they do, don't they?
Arby's has pink slime is what they have.
Isn't that, what's their thing? We've got the meats.
Yeah, but did we ever do pink slime? I feel like, I don't want to traipse into.
It's come up, yeah, right?
I don't want to go too deep into pink slime in case one of our new co-hosts of the upcoming Omnibus Project Part Deux is somebody that's like, you know what I want to talk about? Pink slime.
No one's ever has ever said that.
I bet you we have a listener that knows more about pink slime than you or I ever will.
Oh, guaranteed.
And they want to come on the show and tell me about it.
We'll see.
Tell us all about it.
Save big money on all your electrical needs at Menards. From wire, tools, testers, and more, Southwire is the perfect choice for your next electrical project. They offer innovative products to help you get your project done right. Hurry in today and save big on all Southwire products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
But then in 1937, I mean, one of the challenges that Hormel had was that the old Boston butt, they had more Boston butt than they knew what to do with.
Don't we all?
And they needed a way to sell this as a foodstuff. And if they called it, you know, canned shoulder, canned Boston butt, it was going to be a tough sell.
I mean, Sir Mix-a-Lot would buy it.
Sure.
But maybe he's not enough to sustain a market.
Well, he was probably not even born at this point. This is 1937.
You're right. You're exactly right. That's the problem.
Yeah. On July 5th, 1937... during the Great Depression, and I think I'm very confused. I couldn't find any reason why it was coordinated with our nation's birthday, but they waited. You know, they waited the extra day.
They really wanted it to be on the 4th.
Hormel introduced Spam, which most people, I think, assume is just short for spiced ham.
I thought so.
It's spiced.
Thank goodness.
To sell the shoulderness of it.
That's why I can't eat Spam. It's just, it's too spicy.
It's so spicy.
It's too robust. I'm like, can I have some mild ham or ma'am?
And it's super mashed and chopped and put into a can. It's the shape of a can.
And, and what's the process? Like, what do you think the chunks are that go into Spam? Like, are they like, are we talking about grape nut sized chunks? Are they marble sized chunks? I always think about this when I'm eating pressed meat.
Yeah.
Like, is this mostly from the same pig, but a little part of this corner came from somebody else? Or is this basically, like, McNuggets are basically, you know, like, chicken goo?
Yeah. Well, what Spam is, I mean, it's pork shoulder. It's the
butt?
It's the butt. It's the part that does not have another, like, profitable job or less of a profitable job than, say, bacon and ham.
Yes.
Although there is ham in Spam. And what they do is they grind it up and they mix it with salt and they mix it with water and they actually mix it with potato starch as a kind of binder to get it to be like basically a patty. It's essentially ground beef hamburger. I mean, when we go to one of our favorite restaurants that we're both minority investors in, the Le Pichet, they have different kinds of pâté, mm-hmm. and some of those pâtés are smooth and some of them are chunky.
Right.
Some of them are a little too chunky for my taste.
whatever that country one is.
The that's country the chunkiest. Pate is like, I don't know. It seems like it's like snouts and tails.
It's like a salad.
Yeah, it does. like a fruit salad.
Pig salad.
No, thank you. Although probably it's more gooder than the ones that get, well, except the other pates are made out of like literally the organs ground up into smoosh.
The liver ones are.
The liver ones, yeah.
I don't know. I'd read the less I know about pate, the more I enjoy eating it. Just like with all meats.
Absolutely.
Don't tell me the story of meat.
Don't tell me the
that
story.
That might detract from my culinary enjoyment.
I mean, if you want to come out and say tonight's ham was named Charlemagne and he lived a long and happy life, although we killed him when he was 8 months old, as soon as he got big enough. But so ham, also Spam, in addition to potato starch, salt and water. There's sugar in it because USA.
I'm waiting on the spices. So far, you've just named salt and sugar.
Well, the spices are, there's not actually a lot of spice.
It's basically salt and sugar.
What there is sodium nitrate.
Oh.
In addition to salt.
One of my favorite spices.
Yeah. And sodium nitrate is one of those chemicals that if you look at the quantity of sodium nitrate that they use in European food, for instance, what they find is sodium nitrate is a great preservative for meats, but it works in really small quantities. You can put just a little sprinkle of sodium nitrate in a food and it does its sodium nitrate job. In the US, we use a lot more of it than they do in Europe, partly because, like we talked about in our food coloring episode, sodium nitrate makes meat pink. And if
meat would not be pink without nitrates?
If you think about dead meat, it gets gray.
True.
Pretty fast.
Oh, this keeps it pinked up.
It keeps it pinked up. And the amount of sodium nitrate they use in Europe pinks it up at first, and then it goes gray pretty fast. Whereas in the America, United States of America, we put more sodium nitrate in there to keep it pink longer.
And we're sacrificing our health, I assume.
Oh, sure.
Nitrates are not great for you.
Not the best. I mean, the thing is, you can overdose on sodium nitrate, as we say, overdose on it, and die. You can, and actually there was a weird lawsuit against Amazon not very long ago where because of the way the algorithm works, they were actually selling sodium nitrate along with a how to commit suicide book as a bundle. Like, if you like this, try this. Like,
it's just a slower suicide.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? If you eat a lot of bacon?
If you eat a lot of bacon, I think you process it fast enough, but you can actually like gobble up sodium nitrate. And apparently it's just one more in a million ways to die. Probably better than having a piano fall on you. But not
piano might be pretty good.
Yeah, you'd go pretty fast and you'd go with an amazing chord. Ka-dong!
It's the end of day in the life. Every time someone dies by piano, it might just sound bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to sound bad, whereas the end of day in the life sounds inspiring. We still listen to it to this day. So Spam comes out, and what's weird is Hormel is cagey about what Spam means. They make it sound like it's like the formula for Coca-Cola, like only a few people know what Spam is short for.
They never fly together.
And nobody can quite tell why that would matter. Like, what could it be short for?
Does it affect anything if you know what it's short for? Is it like shoulder pork and ham or something?
I think maybe shoulder pork and ham could be.
Because if I said that real fast, it would sound a little bit like
shoulder pork and ham.
Spam.
Shoulder pork and ham.
Spam.
Obviously, as Spam became popular in the armed forces, they thought that it maybe was an acronym for special army meat.
That sounds like something you'd tell a kid to get them to eat. You have to eat this. It's special army meat.
Some people said it was just ham that didn't pass its physical, which is a little brutal. That's kind of a harsh. I mean, that's like an insult you would say on the playground. You're just ham that didn't pass its physical.
Can I talk about my experience with Spam?
Well, let's hear it. Do you want to jump right into that?
Well, I feel like the cultural trope is that it's like, this is gross, chow line food. My opinion when I first ate Spam is like, oh, it's like ham only better because you don't really have to chew.
That's right.
It's like soft, ready to go ham.
Already.
Like put that in my veins.
Already chewed for you.
And today I'm not some like foodie who's like, oh yeah, let's have Spam Musubi like the Hawaiians do. They know what's up. But the Hawaiians are kind of right. It's pretty good.
Well, so what fortuitously for the Hormel Corporation, who arrived on the scene next? Hitler and Hirohito. And suddenly the world was at war. And it was very hard to supply everybody with good victuals. And the U.S. government recognized that this delicious ham in a can was inexpensive and could be produced in great quantities. Because the Boston butt is big. It's a big Boston butt. There's a lot of this kind of meat available, even as you're making all the other things that a pig can make.
You're trying to feed a big quantity of people on not the biggest budget.
Right.
And it's got to be shelf stable.
That's right.
Spam seems perfect.
And so during the course of World War II, over 150 million pounds of Spam was disseminated through the U.S. military and other aid organizations to troops around the world and people around the world. In fact, Nikita Khrushchev said that they could not, the Soviet Union could not have survived, the Soviet army could not have endured without Spam.
Spam beat Hitler.
Spam beat Hitler, Spam beat the Japanese, Spam went global. It was served to servicemen to the point that they were so sick of Spam that that they actually like rose up in protest of Spam.
So maybe they're like me. At first they were like, oh, this is pretty good kind of ham. And then they just had to eat it three meals
just
a day for months.
I can't eat any more Spam.
And maybe that would happen to me.
For the love of God. But Spam went far and wide and became a staple food, not just during the war, but after the war in the United Kingdom and in Germany. Spam became part of, you know, a big part of the diet because it was still inexpensive and widely available. But also in Southeast Asia and in Central Asia, in most of Asia.
Let's just say in Asia.
Spam went all around. It became a staple food in Guam, Hawaii, Okinawa.
Koreans love Spam. I can tell you that firsthand.
Korea, Puerto Rico. It became a major cultural staple in the Philippines and was actually sold in China or promoted in China and South Korea as sort of luxury products. Even today, South Korea, because a lot of Spam is still made in Minnesota.
Really?
And of Iowa pigs and Minnesota pigs. But Spam has also been subcontracted throughout the world. And
easier to make it from local pigs, cheaper.
South Korea makes more Spam than any country outside the U.S.
Wow. See?
In the Philippines.
They got the demon hunters and they've got the Spam factories.
In the Philippines, there are like a lot more flavors of Spam than we can even imagine. At least 10 different kinds of Spam. Spam is something that isn't seen as just a poor people food, but it crosses all kind of cultural strata. People loving to eat the Spam. And then, as we know, Hawaii, potentially the greatest of all American states, the former Kingdom of Hawaii, is the state that consumes the most Spam per capita. 7 million cans of Spam a year in Hawaiian food. They have you ever had Spam sushi? Spam
musubi? Yeah, it's not my favorite.
Yeah.
I don't love seaweed.
Yeah.
So I tend to eat sushi that's less seaweed forward, and that's not usually true of Spam musubi, but it's good. It's just like onigiri, but with Spam, and I'm pro Spam.
Yeah, pro Spam. I know that about you.
Yeah.
By the time the 50s came around and spam was disseminated throughout the world in this way, it was as early as 1959 that they sold their billionth can of spam.
It's crazy they've been counting all that time. I hope this goes big just so we can...
I know.
We got to count every one.
7,250,000,000.
Some guy just reading big numbers at the end of the line.
I wonder how much of that's an estimation. Now we're over, I think we're over 9 billion cans of spam.
Yeah, it's got to be retroactive. They're like, hey, what big number are we near? And somebody does some rough math and says, we're close to 5 billion.
Well, except in 1959, they were already celebrating the billionth can. If you think about a billion, that's not a number in 1959 they would have even ever heard of.
That's probably the first time people ever, maybe it's the first time they coined the word billion, was to describe the amount of spam there now was in the world. Until that point, there had never been a billion of anything. This was the first thing.
Well, yeah. When did a McDonald's sell its... Okay, so it sold its billionth burger in 1963. So there were...
And they started to put that on the signs, yeah, too.
But Hormel was already past its billionth can of spam. You know, it was like a glimp. The McDonald's billionth burger was a glimmer in Hormel's eye.
I'm just saying all these places are probably doing a rough equation based on average sales. Nobody's ever like, let's keep a running total of all our invoices.
Ding, 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 ding. It was so popular that there were actually, an orchestra, an all-woman orchestra called the Hormel Girls that had like popular songs. The Hormel Girls out there, you know, ha-cha-cha-ing in front of, I guess, Gracie and Allen.
Gracie and Allen? Burns and Allen.
Burns and Allen. Gracie, Burns, Allen.
And George.
I don't even know. Why beep it out? What does it even mean anymore? We're both so punch drunk talking about all the ham that we've been talking about. In 1959, also, Hormel got the Humane Society seal of approval for the way they butchered their pigs. One of the first instances of a company having a a policy of kind of anesthetizing the pigs before they were slaughtered, so that they eliminated the component of fear. Over the years, of course, there have been a lot of subsequent somebody sneaking a video camera into a Hormel supplier, not necessarily a Hormel factory itself, but somebody that's supplying.
That sells
them and then making video of like, well, these pigs aren't having the best day. And so, you know, you can't say like, I mean, a Hormel has always been very responsive to that kind of situation and jumped on it and said, you know, like sever those relationships. I'm not here to tell you that Hormel is like, this is not an advertisement for them.
Hormel is not an animal rights organization. Despite their good effort.
Yeah, I'm going to say
that that's fair enough.
If you were against the idea of spam going into this show, let me only have just given you information and not tried to sway you in one or another direction. Spam now has gone through a period of being treated as a garbage food and is now experiencing a resurrection during the pandemic and during the last two economic crises. Sales of spam have exploded again during the 2007 through 2009. What are we calling that now? Crisis, let's say. Economic crisis in the U.S.
The Great Recession.
The Great Recession.
Housing bubble.
Spam sales through the roof. It's now recognized, I think, as a honored part of Asian cuisine in the places where it's incorporated into contemporary cuisine. So much so that there is quite a bit of spam tourism. There's a spam museum.
In Minnesota?
In Minnesota, where they give out spamples.
That's awful.
There's a movie theater in the Spam Museum that shows the film Spam, a love story.
There's a movie about spam?
There's a spam movie. There are spam festivals, including one in Austin, Texas, as I guess a sister city of Austin, Minnesota. But we talk about spam a lot.
Spamalot.
Because of Spamalot, the famous Monty Python skit of 1970, where two people fly in from the roof, I guess.
Stage up,
fly into a diner. They realize that everything on the menu has spam. One of the patrons says, "I don't like spam." And then the waitress says, "What do you mean you don't like spam?" They're so good.
The Pepper Pot voices.
At being ladies. And then, of course, the restaurant also, because it's a Monty Python sketch, is full of Vikings. The Vikings begin to chant, "Spam, spam, spam, spam." And they're silenced a couple of times. And then they start singing "Can't Be Stopped." And during the early days of email, it may not surprise you that the cultural gatekeepers at the time were nerds.
The only TV shows the early internet pioneers had ever seen were Star Trek and Monty Python.
And Doctor Who.
Right. Because they were all rerun so much that you didn't have to watch anything else.
That's right.
You could always find Star Trek, Monty Python, or Doctor Who reruns.
The tent poles of modern civilization, those three shows. And so the idea of emails that were coming just relentlessly that you couldn't filter out. And I think the originator of the term is lost to history.
But he was reminded of that by the song?
Just like spam, 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 spam. And everywhere you looked on the menu, it was just, you know.
It's funny because it must have been.
Spam, spam.
Right.
Eggs and spam.
Eggs, spam, and spam. It must have been coined before there actually was this avalanche of spam, spam, spam. Because nowadays we live in a world where you can watch your spam email box fill up with spam, 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 spam. But back then, they knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
They knew the vibe was going to be that song, even though they weren't getting that much spam yet.
That and just, I think, that menu where it was like, well, we've got eggs, spam, and ham, and spam, and toast.
Yeah.
Just that there are things in there that you want.
I see.
Eggs and toast.
But then there's layers of spam.
Yeah, you can't get to it because there's spam and everything. And so, yeah, now spam has become a word that we all use every day. You see it and think it all the time.
It must be tricky for Hormel. Because on one hand, it's great brand recognition for their most valuable syllable, but also they don't want to dilute it or to have like negative auras of halos of meaning, right?
Right.
They don't want people to think, oh, all my worst emails I associate with spam. All my good emails I associate with better cuts of meat.
Yeah. I don't know if at the Hormel Spam Museum, a Futurelink can write in and tell us, is there a section on Spamalot?
I bet there is. That's got to be like a cultural high watermark for them. And it's honestly, it's like they would have to pretend they liked it even if they didn't.
Yeah.
The way the Mormon Church advertises at Book of Mormon, like, we love this thing. Now try the book.
We can laugh at ourselves.
Because it looks better than being like Scientologists and saying, hey, shut this down.
Well, and I think it won't surprise you to learn that that Burger King and McDonald's in Asia both serve spam on the menus.
Yeah.
And I think spam now is like a fast food restaurant in a lot of American chains.
I feel like my view of spam has been vindicated by history. Mm-hmm. Like when I was a kid when my mom would fry up spam with eggs and I'd be like, this is good. This is like just like spam only like fatty or like ham only like fattier and easier to chew.
Yeah. I ate spam and eggs a lot as a kid.
The culture has borne that out. Like it wasn't a punchline at all. It should be in Michelin starred restaurants.
That's right. It's come all the way back around and now it's like it has an honored place in American culinary pantheon.
We just needed Asia to show us how great it was.
As in so many things.
Thank you, Asia. And that concludes Spam, entry 1195.JB0607, certificate number 53117, in the omnibus, Omnibus this fall is undergoing a transformation.
Transmogrification.
Transmogrifying into a beautiful butterfly by getting rid of the dead weight. One of the co-hosts got his kids out of the house and wants to travel more, and it's wreaking havoc with our schedule and has been for years. It's playing Ned with our schedule. Let's start saying that more. Playing Ned.
Playing Ned.
Have you ever heard that?
No. What does that mean?
I think it's like Ned is the devil. So it's like a nice way of saying it's playing the devil with our whatever. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it's just something I invented.
Okay. All right. Well, let it be your legacy.
My new legacy is the catchphrase "playing Ned." And as a result, we're looking for a few good futurelings to join our guest host rotation. I won't be the only co-host anymore. I'll still be on the show occasionally, but we'll also be hearing from celebrated friends of ours.
That's right.
From funny people, interesting people, hobbyists and experts of all kinds, but also just listeners who have a story that they would like to add to the Omnibus record.
Yeah, we're making a change primarily in that we're going to try and get some funny people in here.
It's really going to play Ned with our precedent of just having me.
Yeah, well, remember how fun it was to watch the producers of Jeopardy try and find a new host for Jeopardy, even as you were standing there, clearly the next host of Jeopardy.
Expectantly clearing my throat.
Had been the whole time. And Alex, handed you his cufflinks on his deathbed and was like, I'm not saying you should be the new host of Jeopardy, but of course you'll be the new host of Jeopardy. And then for a year, they, toyed with all of our emotions. Think about all the times I pounded on the table before we were recording, where I was like, what is this madness? And you, the faithful, steward, never complaining.
I don't think it was as hard on most people as it was on you.
I was mad.
I think people were like, oh, I like some of these.
No.
I think the virtue of it was, and this is probably how it will function for Omnibus as well, is that really people understood that Jeopardy had a lot of strengths that were not just the identification with one host.
Right.
That in fact, that was not the core of the show. And I hope people discover that about Omnibus, that even though they think that I'm the sole drawing power of it.
Well, now wait a minute.
Now they will learn that you and the format have their charms.
Yes, the format is what's going to sustain us. Well,
our tight format that we do not ever stray from.
The hour and 30-minute long show with 20 minutes of show. It is true, I think, that it's fairly rare that a show of our caliber will lose one of its, one half of its core.
I'm not going anywhere.
No, that's
but
true.
But I won't be here every week for sure.
That's going to be a challenge for some people who are used to your and my witty banter. Because how could I possibly banter wittily?
But then you look at the podcasting space, which is nothing but kind of normal people taking a shot at witty banter, and you realize it's not that hot a commodity.
Yeah,
this can be. I mean, it can't be duplicated exactly with guest hosts, but I don't think it'll be that far afield.
But what I want to discourage people from doing is thinking that you can find this anywhere.
For sure.
You're not going to find the witty banter you're looking for other places. You have to stick it out with Omnibus.
At this point, you're pot committed.
Keep it in your rotation.
What are you doing? Switching to the dollop now?
That's right. You're not going to, if you didn't like it before, you're not going to like it more now. And we will keep the high quality of Omnibus. The quality might even increase.
I think it will certainly increase.
Yeah.
Like Omnibus is a solid 6 with me as a co-host.
Sure.
6.5 sometimes.
Yeah, 6.2. Yeah.
6.2. Let me look at our IMDb average rating.
What does it say?
6.2. No, I'm just kidding.
No. But we have a lot of, you remember to fave and upvote us on
Apple Podcasts or whatever
it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Go to Spork right now and remember to mark us as Sporkiest of the week.
That's right. Marked as safe.
So Omnibus has a very bright future. You are part of it. Stay tuned for surprising developments, like you could watch Omnibus for the first time.
That's right. It's going to be on YouTube.
Something I always vetoed because I thought it would steal my soul.
Yeah. I was like, come on, Ken.
As my culture believes.
Let's do it. Let's do video. And he was like, then people are going to notice that I'm looking at my phone through all of your shows.
I was like, so we can't do the show nude? Or is that the appeal?
Or we have to do it nude. Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe you and your co-host should start an Omnibus OnlyFans.
Oh, Omnibus After Dark?
That's right.
That's going to really limit the number of guest hosts that I'm prepared to work with.
But maybe increase their caliber?
Yeah, but like Eugene Merman? I'm not sure if I'm going to invite him on the show.
What if we found out he was an actual merman?
No insult to to Eugene.
Like he's
he's a merman?
And we just didn't know that because we've only seen him in pants.
Curiouser and curiouser.
It's not impossible. But the Omnibus Project is still, it's still going to be Omnibus. It'll be at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, on various social media platforms. We will, on our website, which you probably don't use that much, omnibusproject.com, you can now go to omnibusproject.com/guest and nominate yourself.
That's right.
For one of the guest hosting slots.
Nominate yourself. You know,
can't get LeVar Burton at this point, so we need you.
You know what? Who knows? He might
is he at the top of your list?
He might feel like this is his opportunity to come back in and say,
this is revenge.
You know what? You know who would have been good at this? Me.
Captain, the Warp Corps needs me to co-host Omnibus.
What I'm now suddenly realizing is that you might now be like in the wings, like tweeting about taking pot shots at me from the side, like, oh boy, this week's Omnibus.
Wait,
it's not like I'm going to listen to it.
In this scenario, am I listening to the show? Because let me comfort you.
Just based on the title alone,
disabusing you of that notion.
Yeah,
I don't listen to it now when I'm on it.
Right.
But I do. No, I think you're probably not wrong that I will keep an eye on it just because you and I will still be consulting together on the show and the direction of it.
That's right. That's right.
Even though I'm not always on air.
And we'll be doing our usual amount of me coming over to your house and Mindy serving me a delicious, succulent Chinese dinner.
I just think it's nice that we'll be able to hang out without feeling like we had to talk about talk about the Little Ice Age for 2 hours.
How much did we? I see. We never did that when we socialize. We never talk about Omnibus at all.
Right.
Unless we're at a party and people come up and they're like, oh my God, can I talk to you about your show?
I just mean we would never talk about like Omnibus. We would not have to podcast.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Like we could just go to lunch. Doesn't that sound nice? Not for the viewers who won't be able to eat or hear.
Kind of like we used to do. Back before we turned it into a show. It's literally why we turned this into a show, was that we would go out and you would be like, did you ever really think about insurance in medieval in Italy? And I would say, as a matter of fact, I have. Why don't we talk about that for
an hour? That was like my go-to first date thing.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about insurance in medieval Italy? And if they have the wrong answer, boy, is that a red flag.
The end. You go guys to the bathroom and you don't come back to the table.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com and always could. You can send us things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Most of the things people send kind of go to you because I think they know you're the pack rat.
I do like things and you don't.
So I think that will not slow down at all. John needs more things now.
More things.
To comfort him.
I'm going to build a Ken-shaped co-host out of the things you send.
He needs a bunch of Ken-shaped components.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind as you send him things. He's going to build the false Ken.
The false Ken.
But it's going to be like a mannequin.
Yeah, a golem. And I'll animate
that's right.
It. I'll animate it to go out and mete out justice.
And write down a Jeopardy clue on a piece of paper and you lick it and you put it in the little slot. And I come to life.
You got it.
And I do your revenge.
That's it.
I do your bidding.
That's the new show.
You can keep track of your fellow futurelings on the Facebook page, but Omnibus does need your support now more than ever. Like it's really unclear who the Cossack futurelings are who will flock to John's new army. And so if you have ever considered supporting the show because, for example, you're such a fan of John Roderick content,
mm-hmm.
Now's the time to put your money with your... You know how much John would love it if Patreon support went up.
I would
after
love
I left.
I really would love it. It would be a thing I brought up at dinner every time.
I would never
time.
Hear the end of it.
Ooh, boy. So, it was really, you were really holding it down.
So if you're Team John now, patreon.com/omnibusproject is where you demonstrate that. This is sad for me, but thank you for your support in both versions of Omnibus, including the jazz blues exploration in front of a festival crowd coming this fall.
Oh, that's right. We're doing a live show, the final, not final, but the penultimate.
The celebration, the keystone.
The keystone, yeah, the big like send-off, let's call
that's
it
right.
That. The send-off for Ken. We're doing a live show here in Seattle at the Town Hall. The show is November 8th. And tickets should be on sale now. Hopefully it hasn't sold out yet. If you are interested in coming to the show, go to townhall, is it .org, probably?
What is there?
Well, I don't know. If you can't figure out where the tickets to this show are sold, Town Hall in Seattle.
They own townhallseattle.org.
Townhallseattle.org.
Don't go to townhall.com, which is some kind of conservative news site.
Yeah, no, don't do that.
I mean, I'm sure it has great content about how you shouldn't be eating seed oils, but it will not sell you omnibus tickets.
I mean, maybe go and just see, because you can't go wrong knowing as much as possible.
Sure. I mean, you probably will think more about securing a white future for mm-hmm. America. That seems like what they're into over there. But I assume our listeners are not so into that, but what do I know?
If you want to see the two of us, Ken and myself, on stage omnibusing, and then I think there's going to be a Q&A afterwards. If you want to come throw bouquets of flowers or slip me an envelope with a kind of Sopranos-level stack of money in it.
It will almost certainly end with me being assassinated from the crowd like Malcolm X, right?
No, I think it'll end in tears. You'll be up there like realizing what you've done, what horrible mistake you've made, and you'll just be like...
in the eighth minute of the standing ovation.
Please take me back.
I'm quitting Jeopardy.
I love you all.
I guess maybe I should have this in my back pocket. I want the show to continue in case Jeopardy goes off the air.
Right, which could happen.
So please, please, please support Omnibus. I need a what do you call it, a parachute?
Yeah.
A landing
place? When the
place?
Last boomer dies, that show's going off the air.
I need an escape capsule.
You do.
Escape pod.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But... the worst comes soon. This recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.